Force field is at 25% strength.
Boost ignition is go.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi Podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital, or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token, or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
Auto sequence start in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible.
There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you could visit cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi Podcast.
Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. We're excited for the upcoming launch of the Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Swap will join the Kava Protocol and Hard Protocol as the next application built on the Kava platform. Celo is a mobile-first platform that makes financial dApps and crypto payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone, providing the opportunity to positively impact the users of 6 billion smartphones in circulation today. Celo's eco-friendly proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and ultra-mobile light client makes up to 17,000 times faster than other blockchains and accessible to mobile phone users around the world. Visit Celo.org to learn more. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. We have our fourth guest for our VC crypto series. Forgot to introduce myself. I'm Tom Shaughnessy. I help lead Delphi Ventures and the podcast. Today, I have on Andrew from Mechanism Capital. Andrew, how's it going?
Hey, it's good, man. Thanks for having me.
Andrew, we're in so many chats together. I feel like we've already done a couple of these podcasts over text, but here we are.
Yeah, Clubhouse or two.
Yeah. So, Andrew, tell us a bit about yourself and your firm.
Yeah, sure. So a little bit about me. I got into crypto full-time around 2018, was at a crypto fund out in California as an analyst, you know, left that around late in 2018 to start a Saft OTC firm. A few other partners, you know, worked those markets for around a year and a half. And kind of while I was doing that, was really active in, you know, a few of the nascent DeFi communities, communities like Synthetics, MakerDAO, ThorChain, and was really interested on a personal basis in investing in kind of growing these protocols. So around when 2020 hit, DeFi summer hit, I decided to, I wanted to kind of leave and do that full time. And that's around when we started Mechanism. And, you know, Mechanism as a firm, you know, some people call us a DeFi focused fund. And we do, to an extent, focus on DeFi. And, you know, we've been really active in some projects, which is kind of how we've built our brand. But really, we invest across the stack in crypto. So we've done everything from investing in mining operations to derivative exchanges like Deribit to, you know, more infrastructure level plays within crypto. So, you know, that's Mechanism. Since we started, we grew from really just kind of myself to now a team of five people. And, you know, while we do focus mostly on venture, we do a good bit of trading as well.
So, Andrew, summer of 2020, crazy yield farming, Yearn comes out, kickstarts the whole space a bit. I mean, you could argue, you know, Synthetics and Compound really kind of champion yield farm, but it was earlier. How did you decide to spend all of the operational legal time to start a firm and a fund when you could have just been, you know, aping into stuff yourself?
Yeah, so we're in a bit of a unique situation where, you know, we don't have LP capital. So, you know, Mechanism Capital is essentially, you know, our prop capital. And so the legal setup was really kind of simple, just, you know, the setup of a few entities. We don't have director of investor relations. We don't have a lot of the operational complexity that, you know, usually takes to manage a lot of outside capital. And so from that perspective, we were able to be really, really agile and kind of jump on opportunities as they came within the same day within DeFi Summer, and really just kind of focus on that.
Yeah, running your own money cuts down on a ton of operational overhead. So that makes a lot of sense that you're the LP and others, obviously. So let's dive right into it. I mean, you're kind of in a unique position because you're so in the weeds with your team. How do you curate the best plays? How do you shortlist it? How do you know where to spend your time? There's just so much going on in crypto at all times. And you opened with the fact that you guys are all over the spectrum, from mining operations to equity to tokens, deal farming. Where do you know where to spend your time and where you'll actually get a return for that time?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, as a team, most of us on the team have been in crypto for a few cycles. Myself being an analyst at a crypto fund 3 years ago, you know, was looking through multiple white papers a day. So by now I've probably looked through a few hundred, if not, you know, 1,000 plus. So there's a little bit of, you know, muscle memory, I guess you can call it, to an extent. You know, projects fall within certain categories that you can kind of categorize really quickly. And projects that really kind of can't explain what they're doing, you're able to kind of push those aside really quickly. And, you know, if something is really unique, then, you know, you're able to say, I haven't seen that before, and kind of delve in and kind of get into the weeds of what that project is really working on. And, you know, besides that, in terms of how we find new deals, we are connected with a lot of really great other investors and also founders. We trust their taste in terms of, you know, what they're bringing to us, what they're recommending to take a further look into.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And I guess, how do you go through that process though? Like, what's your automatic turnoff? Is it just that muscle memory, or is there something in a deck or any, you know, parameters you can give us on stuff that's just an automatic turnoff? Because your time is extremely valuable. Like, an extra hour to look at one project that you're interested in is obviously worth well more than looking through like 10 garbage decks.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, usually if a project is, for example, full of buzzwords, you know, that's usually a big red flag. But, you know, like I said, you can usually categorize projects because a lot of projects, they tackle the same type of problems. So, you know, we've seen at this point dozens of synthetic asset trading platforms. We've seen dozens of, you know, different money market funds, say Aave for Ethereum, Aave for BSC, Aave for, you know, this chain or that chain. And so, you know, that can give us a really quick sense of, you know, what this project is working on. And usually, you know, what we try to do is we don't want to make a lot of investments in the same space. Usually we make just one and stick with it. And so when something is kind of really unique and it's creating a new primitive that hasn't been built before, that's something that we really want to focus on.
So basically you want to focus on new code, new ideas. Is that harder though? Because like you mentioned earlier that your muscle memory is strong, and I totally agree with you. But when you're looking at brand new plays, how do you bridge that gap? Is it the muscle memory you've had for years helps you understand these new projects better? Because it obviously takes a lot longer to build up a thesis and conviction around totally new projects.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, to give you an example, right, if we're looking at a synthetic asset trading platform, we've seen a few that are really just synthetics, right? Except for maybe they're changing that instead of, you know, using only SNX to mint the synths, you know, they're adding a few other forms of collateral. They're tweaking the way that the collateral ratio changes over time. They're changing the universe of synths that they're working with. You know, stuff like that, I would say, if it's really just kind of small tweaks to something that's pre-existing, it's not too interesting for us, but it's something that, you know, we can kind of take a look at and be able to kind of tell really quickly, okay, this is really similar to this project that we've seen before that's out there and, you know, has had success in this or, you know, that way.
Are there any exceptions? Like, you know, take a Cream versus Compound example or a SushiSwap versus Uniswap example. Like, they're not exactly reinventing the wheel here, but they could be attractive investments. Where do you draw the line between copycats when it's something that might be a good investment?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. Cream, Compound, Aave, they're all money markets, right? But you know, they do serve different markets. And so if we look at Compound, for example, you know, that's something that's very blue chip. They're very safe. And so they're very conservative in adding new assets. But you know, Aave and Cream are a little bit less conservative. And so, you know, they serve a longer tail of assets, right? And so while Compound has been out there for a while, Cream and Aave haven't been able to have success because, you know, people are able to put different types of collateral into the system and be able to also borrow different types of assets, right? And so, you know, understanding that a little change can make a big difference in terms of the type of need that's served, that's something that we'll look out for as well.
Up that example you gave, how do you, I guess, revisit your thesis as time goes on, right? I feel like Cream, Compound, Aave, eventually they're probably going to all have the same assets supported, but it's a slow grind of adding assets. It's a little bit of a different thesis. Like, these aren't like major inflection points where you revisit your thesis. It's like a slow process that happens over time. How do you revisit your investments and say, hey, you know what, maybe we should get out of this and it's not as interesting anymore. It's not as differentiated anymore. Because I feel like a lot of people have trouble exiting or kind of rethinking their thesis after they make an investment.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, typically we like to stay with the project that we've invested in long term. And, you know, there are really, really few instances where we say that the thesis has changed or the project no longer lives up to the thesis in some way. But it's really kind of just looking at, you know, at some point, how the product is playing in the market, right? Because these products launch, they have users testing them out. And so, you know, you're able to track on a variety of metrics, daily users, volume, you know, TVL, et cetera, and how that tracks over time. And so, you know, you can easily just take a look at the data and say, hey, look, not very many people are using this, is not getting a lot of traction. Well, you know, then we think to, well, why is that? And then, you know, maybe it's because of an invalidation of our thesis, because there's not a real need in the market to say, like, have a derivatives market to trade, you know, these really exotic assets. You know, one example is, right, is, you know, synthetics adding currency pairs. You know, obviously, you know, there's a big market for trading currency pairs out there, but is there a need for that in crypto? At first, people said yes, but then, you know, once they launched those currency pairs, you could see that there really wasn't a market for it because nobody was trading them. And it's, you know, they've been out for 1 or 2 years so far.
Yeah, you're totally right. The narratives we learn on paper and that we buy into, I mean, I've done this myself, they don't always pan out in the real world. And I'd like to kind of talk a bit about the makeup of the projects you invest in, because there's obviously big debates and a lot of different thinking around what percent VC should take down, what percent a community should have. You've kind of been on both sides of the aisle here because you're writing VC checks, but you're also very active in these projects from a yield farming perspective, from secondary markets perspective. How do you think about community investing, party rounds, what percent ownership you want as a VC, when you have to keep in mind that the community is what's going to drive this forward and they need to be incentivized for the long term?
Yeah, yeah. So I never think it makes sense for there to be only one investor in the entire round. You know, I think when you're talking about bringing on, you know, investors in terms of, you know, fundraising, every investor offers something different, right? So, you know, us as Mechanism, when we're leading around, we have a group of investors that we know are really valuable in multiple different ways. So, for example, we might know these angels are really great at marketing in China or Korea because they run a media business there. They run some type of news outlet. And so we'll know they offer a ton of value for a 20K check. Crypto Bobby, you know, we've had him in a few rounds with us because we know he runs proof of talent. He's great at recruiting and he has a really wide network. And we know that all projects that we work with, they always need help with recruiting. And then obviously, you know, Delphi, right? You know, you guys are great with research, podcast, tokenomics. We've had a great experience working with you guys. So we always try to tap you guys when we can. So party round, I would say like we're always in favor in. Sometimes that means we can't get as big of an allocation as we want, but it's better for the project long term. And you know, if the project's doing better because it's a better group of investors, then we're doing better as well.
Andrew, the joke within Delphi is whenever you send us a deal, instead of just automatically saying yes, we wait a couple hours. So you guys think we're looking into it too. Just kidding. We always dive in, but it's a good answer. And I guess the other side of that is looking at the team, right? So you have an ability to, or you have access to teams in a different way than retail does, right? Like crypto is obviously very open. These founders are out on Discord, they're on Twitter. I get that. But they're going to respond to you before they respond to Joe Schmo on Twitter, right? If you're a retail investor, let's say you're not at Mechanism, how do you build conviction in a team that's, you know, you're only sizing up their past from Discord, Twitter, Telegram, Medium? How do you build that conviction in a team as a retail investor?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's funny because a lot of people, when they talk about VCs, they talk about us as kind of like a different species, but we were all retail at some point, right? I mean, we were all just like you know, had no connections and were just aping into coins that we saw on Reddit and 4chan. And then eventually, like, we found our way into Discord groups and Telegram groups, and we started chatting with teams. And then we find that conversations with some teams are more engaging with others. Some founders are 24/7 talking with the community and playing with ideas with the community, and some are just not responsive at all. And so, you know, those are the projects that, you know, I know both of us got involved with, and, you know, it worked out really well. And so that's been kind of a mantra for us, is to bet on founders that are kind of really in the weeds and kind of open to feedback and just kind of really great at experimenting with new ideas.
Where do you draw the line on the level? You're an extremely smart, one of the most intelligent investors in the space, right? But everyone has their limits in different segments, right? Where do you draw the line as an investor and say, hey, you know what? I don't really understand this aspect or that aspect, but I'm betting they know it, or my contact knows it. Like, where do you draw the line on being okay with what you don't know, but still writing a check or still investing in something?
I think at first I, you know, used to lean on a lot of people's opinion, but, you know, I think usually, you know, eventually you do this long enough where you just kind of learn to trust your intuition in your gut. But that doesn't mean we're an expert at everything. So, you know, sometimes, for example, if say we're looking at something to do with zero knowledge proofs, we don't have a lot of expertise in that, right? But we've invested in founders that we know that might have an expertise in that, or, you know, other investors that, you know, might have a PhD in something like that, right? And so we'll tap those people when that's appropriate.
Yeah, that's a great call. We invested in Arbitrum, and I was looking into Chainflip, and I was like, oh wow, the founder of Arbitrum wrote a lot of these GG20 papers that Chainflip was using, so you can reuse a lot of people there. And I guess the other side of this is, what do you think about founders, or what do you see in founders that really turns you off from an investment? And let's take an example of a project that you really like. Like, let's say you find a project, you really like it, but you meet the founder, you learn about them. What turns you off about a founding team, even if you like the idea itself?
Turns me off about a founding team.
Or what would make you just straight up not write the check anymore? Because there's certain things founders could do, certain aspects. I'm not sure if it's just all qualitative, but I'm wondering what would turn you off, because a lot of people look at founding teams and they're like, oh, I'd never back them, but they don't really give a reason why.
Yeah, you know, I would say I'm more accepting of some mistakes, because there are cases where I think that type of attitude where, you know, people are really quick to turn away founders because of one specific reason has really kind of bit them in the butt. You know, the example is like ThorChain, right? You know, some of the co-founders were involved in projects in 2017, 2018 that didn't go so well, not because, you know, they were scamming people, but just because they couldn't find product market fit. And so, you know, a lot of investors, you know, when they saw ThorChain come out, they said, hey, that project didn't go great, I'm not going to back this project. And so for me, there was a little bit of hesitation because of that at first, and because people were bringing that up as a red flag. But I think, you know, you really had to look past that. But in terms of, you know, what would really be a big red flag in terms of, and have us not write a check, I think it would just have something to do with integrity. You know, if a founder was caught blatantly lying about terms that were set previously, or say his experience or something like that. But that is really, really rare. I can maybe count on my hands like a few times when that's happened.
Yeah, the funny thing is, what I'm learning from a lot of these episodes is I feel like crypto VCs are way more forgiving of whether their personality doesn't line up with a founder's, and if they've had mistakes in the past. But obviously, everyone is not okay with any integrity, any fraud, anything like that. But it sounds a lot more flexible than traditional VC, where I feel like whenever I listen to a traditional VC, they're just like, oh, I love the founder, I was in. But in crypto, it's not always the case.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't need to be able to hang out with a founder. I don't need to be able to have drinks every day with them. If I know they're passionate about the project and they're really pumped about what they're working on, and I know that they can execute and they're not going to give up in a bear market, then yeah, we're ready to back them.
I'm with you, man. Yeah. Drinks every day, I wouldn't get much work done either. And what are your thoughts on, I guess, two things I want to ask you, and I'll let you take it whichever way you feel more strongly about: anonymous founders versus known founders. And I wanted to get your take on, you know, whether or not you'd back anonymous founders. I mean, I know you have personally, but I'd love to get your take on it. And I guess how you build conviction in founders you don't even know, or you might not ever know.
Yeah, I mean, I think before 2020, you really didn't see much anonymous founders in the space, mostly because I think there was a sense of a lack of trust. And so it was hard for them to build a community around them. It was hard for them to raise capital. And then DeFi happened and it's like, oh, wait, I don't have to raise capital to start a project. I can bootstrap this within a few days or a few weeks. And so, you know, I was really excited to see that happen because there were a lot of projects that we saw, you know, 2018, 2019 that essentially failed because they spent all their time and resources talking to lawyers around, you know, what they could and couldn't do. And obviously it's important to stay compliant, but there's also a lot of regulatory uncertainty. Guidelines are not clear at all in certain jurisdictions. And so if a project founder is anonymous, it lets them just focus on the project full time and, you know, not worry about, you know, some of these other things that they might have to deal with. And so projects like SushiSwap, projects like Alchemex, right, that had anonymous founders, you know, they've been able to succeed despite that. And yeah. I think at first, right, there was a lot of, I guess, skepticism with 0x Maki and him taking over Sushi, but, you know, he's been able to win over the trust of the community. He has been able to not take an easy exit when he could have and stick with it for, you know, almost a year now.
He's a really good example of somebody that really got a lot of respect from the community from just consecutively staying with it and building. That's a really good point. And my follow-up question to you is like, do you ever think that these founders will actually decentralize to the community? Like I brought Kane up as a good example, who I guess is attempting to do this, but and he's an incredible guy. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because one, that's the whole point, I guess, is for the community to own it. But on the flip side, I feel like it's way harder to do in practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still pretty far out from seeing this done, you know, within like a larger scale. Because, you know, you mentioned Kane, he left Synthetics as the benevolent dictator, but he came back recently and joined their council, right? I think when he referenced the reason why he was coming back was because there were a lot of coordination issues without him there. You know, there was some conflicting visions around, you know, what was to be prioritized, to be built. And so I don't think we've seen a model just yet of successful transition from a core team to, you know, the community. I would say maybe Yearn is the only example, right? Where, you know, you had Andre start the project and then, you know, really the key contributors driving it now were from the community. But I would say that's more so the exception than the rule. I think there are a lot of things to think about, like proper incentivization that need to be really carefully considered when you're giving away the project to the community. Because like you saw with Yearn, you know, a lot of there was a lot of friction, right? Because a lot of the developers felt like they were not properly incentivized, that they only had such little amount of tokens versus, you know, some other people in the community that weren't doing anything at all. And so, you know, I think incentive structure is something that really needs to be thought through carefully when you're dealing with this type of thing.
No, that's a really good point. You definitely need the team incentivized, but it is a fine line. You definitely want them incentivized for the long term. And I guess just switching gears, I'd love to talk about a couple examples. Let's start with, I mean, you know, the painful ones, the lessons, right? Like what's something that you thought was a major miss on your part or the fund's part? You could take it from, you know, a specific investment or an area to invest in. We'd love to learn, I guess, what you thought your biggest miss was and I guess what you learned from it.
Yeah, I would say off the top of my head, probably Alpha was one of our biggest misses. You know, we
saw
that.
Alpha, man.
Yeah, you guys and Spartan and MultiClan were investing in that one. And, you know, we had a call with the founder and she was great. She was obviously really knowledgeable about DeFi. The team was stellar. I think something about like a mathematics Olympian. But the friction that we ran into there in terms of getting to a yes was we felt that they were way too much focuses. You know, they wanted to do a perpetual derivatives platform. They wanted to do a launch pad. They wanted to do, you know, this leveraged yield farming. And so we felt like they were a little bit all over the place. And, you know, obviously they've been able to execute on almost all three of those by now. And so, you know, really the lesson there for us was to maybe not get stuck on, you know, one small red flag. If, you know, there are a lot of other great factors to consider, right? They were building something innovative with leveraged yield farming. The team was exceptional. They were really fast builders. They've been in this space for a long time. And, you know, so yeah, that was one lesson. Another, I guess, you know, lesson that I like to talk about a lot is the fact that, you know, sometimes there's just one part of the token model or one part of the design that is just not right. And investors can kind of get stuck up on that and, you know, use that as a reason to pass. So for example, you know, we might have looked at a derivatives protocol and said, well, you know, this design won't work because it's unsustainable in this way or that way. But turns out, you know, a small tweak could have been made. And, you know, we could have worked with the team on that. And, you know, that problem would have been solved. So I would say don't get hung up on stuff that can be improved on.
Yeah, those are really good examples. No, and I mean, you're right. I mean, Alpha was biting off a lot. I mean, they have executed, which is good, but I could understand why you thought that. And it's not a bad reason to pass. I guess the other thing to keep in mind is like, this stuff doesn't happen in a tunnel, right? Like you obviously used the funds you were going to allocate to Alpha to something else anyway.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, the space was moving a mile a minute. Opportunity cost was, you know, bigger than, you know, at that time, but, you know, we've since taken a small Alpha position. So, you know, we're happy to be on the same page as you guys.
Hell yeah, man. Glad to hear it. And I guess just on that line of thinking, I mean, there's a lot of ways to like drive edge. And I mean, you obviously have your ways that where you get your edge from the market. I mean, you've been here for a while, you've reviewed 1,000 white papers, you're very active. What do you think if you had to, you know, jump out of your body for a second and look at your investing career, what do you think your biggest edges are as an investor within crypto?
Yeah, I mean, I think our biggest edge is our eye towards incentive design. You know, we were there in the synthetics community when liquidity mining came about. And, you know, we've had a lot of discussions in those early communities as to, you know, how these liquidity mining programs should be developed, how tokenomics should be developed over time, because we've seen cases where token inflation was really, really excessive. And, you know, that pretty much destroyed projects. And so, you know, we've done a lot of thinking around how do we get both founders, investors, community members, the right amount of skin in the game where everyone's aligned and pushing forward on the same goals? And how do we, you know, remove dead weight, right? Where, you know, we don't have a lot of tokens in the hands of people that are not so interested in the project. And, you know, also thinking about what is the impact of, say, you know, token inflation or float on a project over time, because we've also seen a lot of projects launch where they've launched with a really small float, say like 1% of the total supply. And, you know, that's destroyed the project because they end up giving so much of because, you know, the market pushes the prices up way too high. And, you know, whenever they release tokens on the market, the price declines and, you know, no community is able to be built because everyone's just too discouraged. And so just kind of having been through those experiences and understanding the incentives at play have been able to help us build a name in the space for that. And so, you know, that's something that we work with a lot of project founders on. And, you know, also people come to us for help on that.
Your example of the very small supply and circulation, high price, then price comes down as tokens get released, no APY, community leaves. I can't count how many times that's happened. I mean, it's such a red flag to someone like you, but to most in crypto and retail, they see the high APYs and they think it's going to last forever. Like they think it's just hard to, I guess, size that up. I mean, just looking into the token econs of projects, like what's your process there? Like, let's say you love a project, but you have to tweak the token econ. What do you look at first? Is it the supply? Is it the incentives? Like, how do you go about redesigning it? I mean, we've done a lot of it ourselves, but I would love to kind of get your start to finish here because it's where you add a lot of value.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, the first thing we look at is like, what is the float at launch, right? If it's 1%, that's obviously, you know, a big no-no. You know, typically we tell projects to aim for something 15 to 20% at absolute minimum. But, you know, aside from that, we're looking at inflation over time. So say something is, you know, say a project inflating their token supply by 500% within the first year. And there's a lot of projects that do that. You know, that's also a red flag. Say too much of the supply is going to the founders or the investors or to, you know, liquidity mining incentives. There's always a right balance, right? And so we can kind of draw from inspiration from early DeFi projects, you know, like Synthetics or like Alpha, that, you know, we can say that they did these things right or they did these things wrong. And, you know, you can look at these metrics that could be tweaked this way and, you know, apply that to new projects that we've been working with.
Do you care a lot about the governance process? Because I guess as much time as you spend on the token econ and nailing it from the get-go, when this stuff gets released in the wild, everything changes, right? I mean, not everything, but a lot. So there's always has to be ways to kind of tweak token econ, make changes, stuff like that. Do you care how easy it is to do that? Or do you look for a specific governance process to do that when you invest? Or is it basically, you know, hey, we'll figure it out. We did our best at the get-go.
I mean, when it comes to governance, I mean, I think it's a bit of a nuanced topic because, you know, teams that we've seen that work with really centralized structures at first, you know, usually they're able to, you know, operate a lot more efficiently, while ones that are a lot more decentralized at first and they, you know, try to go the full DAO flat structure approach, you know, they operate really, really inefficiently. And so, you know, usually when we work with teams, we try to find a bit of a middle ground to kind of transition from the fully, you know, operationally efficient model to one that is, you know, more, I guess, decentralized and flat over time.
Yeah, no, you're right. The ultra flat structures are just so inefficient from the beginning. It's dumb. And I guess going back to the examples on Token Econ, what's an example of a project that you think has just absolutely crushed their Token Econ from the get-go? Like, you know, supply, incentives, where the tokens are going, founder lockup, investors, if there are any. Just give us an example of one that you thought absolutely crushed it.
You know, it's funny. I think the best projects that absolutely crushed it were the ones that launched in 2017, 2018. I wouldn't say that they crushed it, but it was just good, the fact that they, you know, released all the tokens up front, because, you know, that allowed a lot of the dead weight to drop out and for people to essentially get in to a project at relatively attractive valuations, because, you know, the market wasn't artificially holding these projects up to a really high supply. And so essentially, like any project, right, like Aave, for example, right, that had investors in 2017, 2018, but, you know, those investors ended up leaving and dropping the token to a really low valuation. And you know, new investors are kind of able to come in and scoop that up and able to kind of grow the project over time. You know, that was a project that I wouldn't say like necessarily had good token econ, but it was good in the sense that it worked with the market cycle. But in terms of project that has done that more recently, let me think about one. I mean, I don't think Alpha was bad, right? Because they had the Binance Launchpad where they were able to kind of distribute a lot to retail. Investors had like a little bit of liquidity up front, but most of the investors that were in were in long term. So, you know, they were sticking with the project, but then they also had a good amount of tokens that were vesting over time. And so, you know, it's not like they were exiting from the project. And then, you know, they had a really healthy amount of tokens available for liquidity mining incentives and also enough for the team to stay incentivized, right? So they really had a full balance there.
That's a unique take. I haven't heard somebody reference like the original 2017-ish type projects. And I'd like to think through with you kind of on the token econ and the incentive side. Like when you and I look at a project, we're looking for, I guess, what makes the token successful in months and years, right? But how do you think through what the project will become and the token supply it'll need for incentives down the line, right? I mean, Wi-Fi is a great example, right? Like no inflation, no issuance, no, you know, tokens for Andre long-term or the team, right? And obviously Andre is an incredible guy. So, I mean, he's building forever. But for most projects, who knows what they're going to need in 5 years? How do you account for that? How do you think through those supply buckets beyond like what you initially need?
Yeah. So, I mean, like something that we always talk to founders about is the fact that, you know, these token supplies can be malleable. Try to carve out a portion that will last you a lifetime. But it's okay if it doesn't, right? It's okay if, say, you burn through it in 10 years, because not every project has to be a Bitcoin and have a fixed supply. These projects are, you know, more similar to traditional, I guess, like corporate models than they are to, you know, digital gold. And so say you've used up all of the, you know, tokens within 10 years, but you still need tokens to incentivize new employees, or you still need tokens to incentivize new growth through liquidity subsidies, that's okay. But if you are, you know, minting more tokens, you have to have a plan for it. It has to be informed. You can't be wasteful about it because you're effectively diluting, you know, previous token holders. But the, you know, the fact of the matter is the previous token holders are the ones that are going to be voting for this minting, right? So they're not going to be minting tokens willy-nilly. So I think, you know, that's something that we like to tell founders, that it's okay. Try to get it as best as you can, but you're not going to know if 50% to liquidity mining incentives is the right number compared to 40%. It's you know, best guess.
Oh, that's a great answer. I mean, basically what you're saying is that you know, it's not two separate groups. It's the first group voting in the changes, which was the second iteration. And third, and two, you know, you can't even have these debates on minting more or anything if you're not successful to begin with. So you have to get there. I'd like to shift gears a little bit. You opened with, you guys are investing all over the map, which is incredible. You recently invested in PleaserDAO, which is super interesting. Would love to get your thesis on PleaserDAO, and if you want, NFTs more broadly, because it's obviously a massive interest for most of us in the space.
Yeah. So, you know, PleaserDAO was a really interesting project because it wasn't really per se like a venture investment at the time. It was more so, you know, a friend was releasing an NFT on Foundation and, you know, we just wanted to support her. And so, you know, I made an opening bid and found out eventually that, you know, some other, a group of people were bidding against me, and those people bidding against me were actually friends. So, you know, Alex Savenovic from Nansen and Daniel Armitage from Nansen and a few others. And so, you know, when we found that out, we were like, well, it just makes sense to bid together and, you know, as a DAO. And so, you know, we won the auction as a DAO. Ownership of the DAO was distributed based on however much each person contributed. And then we eventually saw that there were other cool projects, and we decided, hey, why don't we take these down as well? Why don't we form a thesis around, you know, really culturally significant NFTs that we want to represent, that we want to bring to the mainstream, that, you know, we want to make charitable contributions towards? A lot of the NFTs that we bought, the Snowden NFT, for example, you know, those proceeds went to the Stay Free Foundation. And so, sorry, Freedom of the Press Foundation. And so, you know, those are going to public goods. The Tor project released an NFT, and, you know, those proceeds went to open source development of the Tor project. And so, you know, we see an opportunity to do a lot of public good, and at the same time, bring NFTs more mainstream. And there are kind of ways that we're cooking up that we're, you know, that are going to accomplish that I, you know, can't really talk about just yet. But, you know, follow PleaserDAO on Twitter and you guys will be able to follow along.
Yeah, no, we have some relationship given our NFT fund and who's involved there and PleaserDAO. So I'm very excited for it. And I mean, to play devil's advocate, the middle of the bell curve podcast host right now, I'll take the other side of this to get your take. What's the exit, right? Like the Doge meme, like you're not like battling with an Axie earning revenue. It's not like a revenue generating thing. Is it just the fact that eventually someone will pay more, or like as an investor, how do you view the exit on some of the more artistic NFTs, but NFTs that don't exactly inherit like the crypto tribal valuations that like CryptoPunks have gotten, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, all of our NFTs are, you know, necessarily going to be monetized, but I would say a lot of them can. Some of them will just kind of have inherent value over a very long-term period. I think, for example, like Doge was incredibly undervalued in the sense that this is probably like the biggest meme in the history of the internet. You know, Dogecoin itself is a multi-billion dollar asset, and even clones of Dogecoin have become multi-billion dollar assets. So the fact that it sold for $4 million, I think that was an absolute steal. And, you know, you could just take the opinion that, you know, we're just going to hold it for, you know, an extended period of time and resell it. Or, you know, you could take the opinion that, hey, maybe we're going to fractionalize this and open ownership of this NFT to more people. Or, you know, maybe we're going to put this NFT into some type of mainstream application or give it more exposure in some way and make it interesting for retail and give it more value as well. And so that eventually, if we do sell it, it'll be for a higher price. Or if we decide to fractionalize it, the fractionalized pieces will go for a higher price. But, you know, a lot of those thoughts are still in the works.
Yeah, if I don't plug Andy from Fractional right now, because he's one of my favorite investments we've made, I'd be remiss. So hopefully he's able to do that for you guys. And I mean, the other questions for you is just your experience within any DAO. I mean, you could take PleaserDAO as an example. You could take any other ones you've been a part of. What has the experience for you been like working within a DAO, investing within a DAO? Because at Mechanism, small IC, at PleaserDAO, potentially a lot, right? Coordination stuff. Do you think that DAOs are ready for prime time beyond like very intelligent investors and stuff like that? Because it seems like obviously it's where the world's moving, but it still seems super early on coordination, tooling, and everything you need to make one successful.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still in a very kind of primitive era for DAOs. There's a lot more thinking, I think, that can go into, you know, forming a DAO in terms of how they can be structured, how decisions are made, because, you know, like you said, it'd be very tough if every single decision was voted on by every single member of the DAO, and PleaserDAO, there are 50 plus members, right? And so, you know, there does need to be some sort of delegation or federation, right? And so within PleaserDAO, you know, we've developed a council where, you know, they're in charge of making higher level decisions related to financials or different directions that the DAO wants to go into. You know, there are certain roles being formed within the DAO where certain people are in charge of, say, corralling people together for a vote, or, you know, setting up a legal entity, or finding new NFTs to start bidding on. And so we've been kind of going through the strokes ourselves and kind of learning through the process. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge working with a large group of people versus a smaller group.
Now, I'm not in PleaserDAO, but talk about DAOs more generally. I feel like eventually most things centralize if they're not checked. Like, you know, maybe there's three or four smart people who just spend more time in a DAO, right? And they, you know, lead discussions and stuff. But eventually that means you're basically back to a GPLP structure with four people running the DAO, right? How do you envision DAOs maintaining their decentralization long-term? Because I feel like it's very hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think that's where DAOs are going. I think there's a reason why companies exist the way that they do today with, you know, how, you know, there's a leadership hierarchy, there's certain corporate governance rules. And that's because there weren't companies before. And then people started companies and they realized that there were certain efficiencies and there were better ways to do things. And, you know, that's how we got to where we are today. And so I think DAOs are kind of going through the same motions and they're realizing that we can't be completely flat organizations. We need roles and responsibilities. We need certain people to be able to make executive decisions. And I think that's fine. But I think like where DAOs can still differentiate is that, you know, they have a group of shareholders that are actually active and driving decisions and being helpful to the firm. They're not, you know, passive shareholders as if, you know, I or you bought a stock of Apple, right? Like everyone brings something to the table, whether it's say connecting us with a famous celebrity that's launching an NFT or plugging us in with a video game that would be really interested in working with our NFTs or, you know, working with a publicist, right? So there's a bit of a differentiation, but I do think DAOs will evolve a little more into, you know, traditional corporate models to a sense.
I totally agree with you. I guess the narrative within the space, though, within crypto is decentralization, flat hierarchies, you know, stuff like that. But in reality, the coordination just overhead is insane, right? Like if I'm a smart contract dev, I don't want to be like messaging 34 people every day to vote on some specific thing, right? I just want to write code. Do you think the trade-off between having that traditional corporate structure within a DAO is worth it because you reduce the coordination issues, or do you think eventually we'll figure it out? I know you just said that eventually, like right now, the corporate structure makes sense, but do you think there's a way where DAOs can actually be truly like community owned, where everyone has a fair vote, where the coordination issues like come down to zero?
I mean, I think they even within, I guess, you know, these DAO models, which have, I would say, like delegated decision-making responsibility and, you know, people that have more centralized roles, there is still kind of a sense of community ownership in the sense that, you know, these people were voted into the positions that they're in today, right? And if you kind of look at previous DAO models, you know, the ones that are burdened with excessive token-based voting, they essentially kind of fall prey to voter apathy. You know, MakerDAO, for example, you know, at first you had like a huge percent of the token network voting, and then it just became less and less and less, where, you know, it was just kind of a few people or a few organizations driving the decisions at the end of the day. And I think, you know, that just kind of speaks to the fact that people don't have the capacity to vote on every single decision, and they're perfectly okay with delegating to other people because they trust those people to make the decisions that they would also probably make themselves.
Yeah, that's a good example. It's come up a lot. I mean, I remember those early MakerDAO stability fee calls, and they were fun as hell in the beginning, right? It was like a great group of people. It was exciting. And then like on the 32nd one, it was like, all right, we can keep doing this every week.
Yeah. I remember like, you know, my very first one, there was probably like 50 people. And then I joined one a year later, there's 4 or 5 people in it.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. You thought when you first joined that it would grow in people. It went the opposite direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a bit of other questions for, I guess, more of the retail audience, but would love to get your take. You are a new person in crypto. You dive right in. You're learning as much as you can. You're not extremely well off, but you want to change your life. You want to back projects. Would you propose to them to be concentrated in their investments, or would you propose a diversification strategy for most people in retail, or you could talk at the fund level?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I would lean towards the, you know, the concentrated bet type of strategy. I think if you're going to be investing in something, you better be really sure that whatever you're investing in has product market fitted, as a team that can execute. And for average retail, it's not their full-time job. So you just don't have the capacity to due diligence 20 different projects, right? You can really only do it for a few. And, you know, for them, I guess you might also not have the same acumen or experience. And so maybe you'll also want to lean on, you know, investors in the space that you've seen have a good track record and look at what they're looking at, and also just maybe be able to kind of lean on their judgment or kind of follow the same research that they're looking at and use that to be able to inform your judgment.
Yeah, that's totally a fair take. And, you know, it's something I think about a lot just because, you know, we were on a fund too, but what do you think the future of VC investing in crypto is, right? Like, to your point, like, you know, probably biased here, but we add a lot of value, token econ, strategy, media exposure, like all those things. But it seems like a lot of the space is obviously moving to on-chain DAOs, which I think will be, you know, extremely important. Like, we run our NFT fund on Syndicate. But do you think that there is a place for VCs in crypto in 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. It's kind of weird when we think of the word VC, because I still don't really like think about myself as a VC, because
two years ago, right?
Like, yeah, we were just regular people just, you know, investing in projects, aping in, right? And we still just ape in, and we just speak our thoughts on Twitter. And it just, you know, we paid someone to make a logo for ourselves. But, you know, you can't just, I guess, what is the other option, right? Like, you raise completely from the public, right? And I think that can go well to a certain extent, because, you know, there are community members that are just going to be really driven and really help you to a certain extent. You know, maybe they'll build tools for you, or maybe they'll become a validator. But, you know, there are kind of just certain experiences that professional investors that have been in the space for a while, you know, they're able to kind of lean on and be able to help new founders with. So a lot of the new founders in the space, right, they work through a lot of the same challenges that every other project that has launched before them has faced, but they don't have that experience themselves yet. And so, you know, as a professional investor, we've seen how a public auction can go on Miso versus, say, on Gnosis versus on another auction platform. And we'd be able to kind of tell you the differences in terms of, you know, how those are structured, or what are the trade-offs between launching this way or that way. And, you know, we might be able to connect you to an exchange that you otherwise wouldn't be able to connect to, or, you know, a media outlet, or, you know, this or that. So, you know, we build a platform so that we can be the most helpful that we can be. And, you know, that's just something that you wouldn't be able to get from an average, I guess, retail investor.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I actually am starting to hate the term VC because, I mean, even though that's the subject of this whole podcast, is just because, like, I love investing with my partners, right? Like, what are we going to do? Just like dissolve our funds so we can invest individually, just to remove the notion of a VC? Like, it's dumb. And the other thing is, it's not like legacy, right? It's not like we're investing other people's money and come back in 7 to 10 years, right? Like, we're out here designing tokens, being active. So I think the term has to change. But to your point, I don't think that there's that large of a gap between retail and like what we're doing.
Right. I mean, we're like retail, but we do it full time. And, you know, we have a logo, and we find ways to help founders.
Logo's the differentiator. Yeah. I agree. And Andrew, to close out, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, personal questions. You've been in crypto a long time. You spend an insane amount of time in the space. The depth that you go to while you're working is extremely dense. How do you deal with taking time off, not getting burnt out, taking a break? Like, how do you actually go about doing that in practice?
Yeah, it's been tough. You know, I wouldn't say like, you know, there's much like work-life balance for me personally, but you know, that's fine. And I think everyone has different needs in terms of, you know, how much time they need off. I mean, some people just need, you know, 2 days off a week to be able to properly function, while other people, you know, they don't. Like, look at SBF. The dude like lives in his office and he like,
Jesus, he sets the bar, man. Why do you got to put him up on a comparison?
Yeah. He just like, he's like probably dreaming about work. But yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I feel like I have a higher tolerance for, you know, less vacation. Crypto is just something that's just constantly interesting. And so I don't really think about it as work. And so that, you know, that helps.
No, that does help. And a different question kind of on that topic, but you're spending so much time because there's alpha, right? And there's opportunities. When do you think that bar closes? Like, when do you think crypto will be not as interesting, not that alpha, much alpha to be had? Do you think it's in a year, 10 years? Think it's forever? When do you think the alpha goes away for you?
You know, I don't think it ever goes away, right? Like in traditional financial markets, they've been around for centuries, but like The meta just changes, right? And so, you know, there are certain things that we were really good at, which is, you know, finding new projects really fast because we were, you know, in these Discord groups and Telegram channels where people were sharing them, that, you know, just kind of erode over time. And now you're seeing tons of these groups pop up and, you know, information just spreads really fast. And so, you know, for us, alpha, it's different from a venture perspective and a trading perspective. From a venture perspective, it's continuing to, you know, build a brand in the space that, you know, we are really value-add investors, that projects that we've worked with in the past, we've been able to kind of make a difference with. And then on the trading side of things, you know, it would be looking for just kind of different inefficiencies in the market, right? Looking at market structure in a particular way that others aren't looking at it. You know, Kyle Davies, when I was kind of first starting out in the space, told me something that, you know, really stuck with me, which is that like alpha really isn't the strategy. Like alpha is the person. So, you know, as long as you have that mindset of being able to kind of look in new places for alpha, or being able to just have that mindset of being creative and thinking about things other people aren't. I know that's really general, but you know, that's alpha.
God, that's a killer quote from Kyle. Jeez, yeah. No, I've had him on. He's a legend, especially Suzu too, and Arthur, who was actually on the series. I was going to ask you next the best advice you've ever been given, but I'm assuming it's probably the Kyle quote, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can say that.
Yeah. What, I mean, flipping that on its head, what do you think the best advice you give is? Like, maybe it's to a founding team, maybe it's to the people you work with, maybe it's to retail investors. What do you think's like advice that you just give over and over again that really sticks with you that you like to give?
Yeah, I mean, I think my advice, you know, what I tell my team constantly, what I tell people that I work with is just to dig deeper. You know, I think that applies, and that helps a lot in a lot of different things, right? Through investing, through building a project, through trading. And so, you know, to think about investing, first of all, right? Like a lot of people miss DeFi, a lot of professional investors and retail miss DeFi at first because, you know, they just were, you know, they weren't kind of thinking about, you know, the applications 2 years on, 3 years on, you know, how these incentives were going to go about, how liquidity mining was going to be able to kind of bring a lot more people and money into the game, how, you know, a certain project might have a really large amount of product market fit, and then also how projects might not work, right? You know, there are a lot of projects that, you know, were invested in by, you know, really big name VCs that didn't work because, you know, they had some mechanism that was really faulty and, you know, that blew up in, you know, everyone's faces. And for founders, right, it's kind of thinking deeper around how do I design my tokenomics? Don't just borrow from, you know, the status quo. Don't just do a token model because that's what other founders have done in the past. Try to think from first principles, essentially.
No, I'm totally with you there. It makes a lot of sense. And just to close out, Andrew, there's like so many plays that you could be happy about that Mechanism has done, right? We've done some with you, some we've just seen you have incredible success with. What though gives you a sense of accomplishment with the play? Like, is it, you know, not just the price, not just the return, but like, what do you want to see happen? Like, you know, founder, pay off his kids' college or change the world, like a play to unlock capital in different regions. Like, what exactly is it for you that gives you a sense of accomplishment for a winner?
I really love it when a project brings more people into crypto or brings more people into building on a platform. So, Thorchain, for example, at first it was just kind of the project team building. And then they ended up funding a few more teams, one to build XDeFi, right? That was incubated by the Thorchain team that, we worked on with them. ThorSwap was a project that was incubated by them as well. And then you have, Broker, which is building, Synths using ThorFi. And so the project teams that are now building these projects were just kind of investors. They were, had full-time jobs in non-crypto industries. And then, the interest in crypto and the success of the project brought them deeper into crypto and allowed them to pursue it full-time. And so that's really exciting for me, right? And I know you guys have kind of seen the same thing with Terra, and we've seen it with Synthetics as well.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent answer. And we have time for one more question because I want to keep these all at an hour. But who do you look up to in the crypto space or just in life in general, and why?
Who do I look up to in the crypto space? That's a really good question.
It's hard. It's not an easy question when you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, Three Arrows has been really influential in terms of, our development as a firm and, also my personal development. They followed a similar path. They were trading kind of, prop capital. And, I didn't really have professional experience in trading in capital markets before a few years ago. And so, a lot of what I learned within the last few years came from talking through to Sue and Kyle and understanding how they think about markets and also, how they think about investing as well. And so we've been able to kind of share a lot of great insight, both based on, what we specialize in.
Yeah, no, that's an incredible answer, man. I joke that it's their world and we're living in it, but I don't know if it's a joke. Andrew, it's been incredible having you on, man. I love investing alongside you when we can. And I loved having you on and all the answers you gave and all the alpha you shared. Where could people follow you and find out more?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at RuKang, RewKang. So
cool. Yeah, no, I'll link it in the show notes, man. But thanks so much for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible.
There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you could visit cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi podcast.
Before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, the Kava platform is launching Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more today by visiting kava.io. Celo is an open platform for mobile-first DeFi with a vision of bringing decentralized financial tools and services to anyone with a mobile phone. Eco-friendly, Ethereum-compatible, and governed by Celo holders, Celo's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and automatic daily carbon offsets make Celo the world's first carbon-negative blockchain, offsetting over 2,200 tons of carbon to date. To learn more about how to lend, earn, and stake with Celo's growing family of platform-native stablecoins, visit Celo.org today.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.